best case scenario, what I was hoping for was that if I could just hold on for long enough, it would stop snowing, I could dry some gear and get out of there. So I settled down under this little large rock, and that'd be where I stayed for the next 6 weeks.
G'day, I'm Richard Harris, and thanks for joining me on Real Risk, the adventure podcast. Hi, Richard Harris here. Welcome back to Real Risk, another great episode in store for you today. I hope you're enjoying the mountain month. Last week we had Jimmy Chin, and today another extraordinary episode involving adventures in the mountains of the Himalayas. Today's episode brought to you, as always, by Bremont, the makers of wonderful timepieces from the United Kingdom, tested beyond endurance. Now, they say we can live for 3 minutes without oxygen, 3 days without water, and 3 weeks without food. But in fact, people have lived for over 60 days without food in hunger strikes in Ireland in the 1980s. Bobby Sands was the first and famous of those political prisoners to die from a hunger strike. And history is full of examples of people who have lived for extraordinary periods of time without food and only water. One such man is James Scott. Now, James didn't intend to starve himself when he became lost in the Himalayas, in what proved to be one of the most extraordinary survival stories of the modern era. I was lucky to meet James at a conference, a medical conference, where I was giving a talk, and I was seated with him at the dinner table. And his story struck a real chord with me as I listened to it unfold over dinner, and I was reminded by the controversy that surrounded his story. It was just almost too amazing to be true, and he was met with a great deal of scepticism on his return to Australia. It was great to catch up with him then, and it was even better to hear the full story on Real Risk. James, great to see you again.
Yeah, good to be with you, Harry.
Now, we first met at a conference last year, I think it was, and we were seated at the same table. I was giving a talk to a group of psychiatrists, of which you were one. The host, I recall, put us at the same table and introduced us, and obviously we were talking about the reason that I was there, which was the Thai cave rescue. But then he turned and said, oh, you might like to meet this fellow, Harry, James Scott. He's got an interesting story. So I turned to you and said, what's your story, James? And then as you described what your story was, it all started to ring a very familiar bell. And I remembered at the time in 1992 when your story unfolded, I was in the UK. We started to hear about this amazing survival story from this young man in the Himalayas. So tell us what was going on in 1992 when you headed over to Nepal. What were you doing?
Harry, at the end of my fifth year in medicine, which was actually in 1991, December 91, I went over to do an elective, doing a little bit of work in Nepalese hospital, getting some work experience in Nepalese hospital. And before getting started, we thought we'd get in a trek. And so we headed up into what they call the foothills of the Himalayas. These aren't the actual Himalayan mountains, but they're the sort of hills leading up to the Himalayan mountains. They're still pretty high, so the passes are sort of over 4,000 metres when you cross them. And we selected this five-day trek, which was supposed to be a fairly gentle trek. And along the way, we got talking to some other tourists who said, oh, you're wasting your time doing that trek. It's boring. Why don't you go and have a look at the Gosakun Lakes? They're much more interesting. Go across this pass and you'll be able to have a look. Just spectacular. And, you know, being a young male, I was 22 at the time, the frontal lobes of my brain were about as developed as every other 22-year-old males are. I thought, oh, this is too good an opportunity to pass up. And took off up there with the gentleman who I was trekking with, who I just met a day or two earlier. On the 22nd of December, we set off. And the way it works is sort of this trail that's sort of well marked, and every 4 hours or so there's a little hut, a little tea house, and you can stop in a tea house and stay at night. So we'd stay at night in this tea house about 3,600 metres of elevation. So we sort of woke up. It's pretty cold. It's very cold. And we had to trek up over this pass, which is about 4,200 metres, and then we cross that and then descend on the other side. And it was just the slightest sprinkling of snow on the ground. And we set off, a few clouds around. And a couple of hours after setting off, the snow started pelting down. So the clouds really closed in and the snow started coming down very heavily. We quickly lost our trail. It was that sort of whiteout situation where I couldn't discern what was the ground and what was the air in front. You're just so disorientating. And I'd never actually really seen snow before. So it was my first experience of it. And I said to my companion, I said, look, I think we should turn back. Mark had a plane to catch. He said, I want to continue on for a bit longer. And I think because we didn't know each other really very well, it sort of matched up for convenience. There wasn't a sort of agreed how we're going to manage this and such. So I turned back to find the hut, which we'd stayed at the night before, thinking it was the safest option. I descended and lost the path. I'd lost the trail, well and truly. But there was a small creek that I could descend along, so I descended along this creek. And I came across these little planks of wood, which went across the creek. And I knew that within about 200 metres, the hut I was in the night before was within about 200 metres of this bridge. But, you know, it was sort of cliffs and everything. This was wild and rugged terrain. And I couldn't find these huts. And, you know, the snow was howling down. The wind was blowing. It was freezing cold. And I took out the map and I thought, okay, well, if I just keep following this creek down, I'll be able to find my way to these villages of Talu. And so I thought that's the plan. And so for the rest of the day, I descended and I got lower and lower. I was sort of feeling better because I'd sort of gone from this very alpine country where there was no coverage through to where there was sort of more trees and coverage. And although it was still snowing, I didn't feel quite so exposed.
Wow. Did that mark your first night in the bush?
I stayed the night. I sort of got off my, got my wet clothes off. And got my sleeping bag, stayed the night under a rock that first night and then woke up. You know, and the snow had been sort of coming down all night and then sort of set off again. And so the next day started really badly. I fell through some ice and fell into a creek and then got a lot of my gear wet and then had to sort of climb out of that and then kept hiking for the rest of the day. And then by that night, had come across sort of cliffs and waterfalls and other terrain, which was just impassable. And I found a sort of rock overhang to stay under. And there I sort of changed into my last set of dry clothes. And as the sort of light faded, I was thinking, I'm not going to survive this. Now, this is going to be the end of me. And I wrote a letter to my fiance, Gay, and to my family saying farewell, explaining what had happened. And I still remember that night. I just shivered and shivered throughout that night. It was so cold. And it was really with amazement that I saw a light come up the next day. I was still shivering. It was still freezing cold. But I thought, okay, I've got to get out of here. So I changed back into the clothes that I'd been wearing the previous day. They were sort of, I didn't want to get my last set of dry clothes wet again, so got out of the clothes I was wearing, which were dry, put my sleeping bag away, got into the clothes which I've been wearing. They'd actually frozen. They were sort of like a board of ice. And so I shattered the ice off and put them back on and sort of kept hiking from there. And I was probably able to hike for about 3 or 4 more hours. But by this stage, when I was stepping into the snow, if I get into a gully, I'd sink down up to my waist. And I'd sort of get out and sort of thigh deep and then back into waist deep and such. So I was making very slow progress. I was getting excruciatingly cold. And I passed by this sort of massive rock. It was like the size of a house and had this huge sort of area. Well, when I say huge area, it was a large area underneath. And there was remnants of people that had been there. There was an old campfire and some handles, sort of some tools, an axe or something. And at this stage, I really didn't think I was going to get out alive. I thought, actually, there's a very high likelihood I'm going to die up here and I won't be found. I thought, at least if I die here, my body will get found. That was a kind of the sort of worst-case scenario. I thought, at least my body will get found. Best-case scenario, what I was hoping for was that if I could just hold on for long enough, it would stop snowing, I could dry some gear and get out of there. So I settled down under this little large rock, and that'd be where I stayed for the next 6 weeks.
And what happened to the weather? Did it stop snowing?
The snow kept, I thought, oh, it might stop snowing and such. It just kept snowing and snowing. So I settled under a rock on Christmas Eve. It kept snowing right up till New Year's Eve. It just kept coming down and coming down, coming down. Just amazing. And, you know, there were some hard days there. Christmas Day, I was very much thinking of the family and being away from everyone and such. And I just kind of kept saying to myself, you know, I just need to sort of hold on long enough to get out of here. I was keeping myself hydrated by drinking the snow, so I'd get the snow together. I'd try and get it out into sort of into sun where I could and let that melt a bit. And I can remember days when there'd be sort of glorious sunlight and the snowballs would melt a bit and I could just suck sort of water rather than sort of having to eat ice. It was just fantastic. It's amazing when you get everything taken away from you, how much you appreciate very small things. So Christmas passed, New Year's Eve came and went into a new year now, into 1992, and it stopped snowing. By this stage, I'd tried all sorts of vegetation to eat. None of it was edible. I had with me a couple of chocolate bars, which were kind of became famous, for better or for worse. They were gone on the second night when I thought I was going to die. I wasn't going to die with food in my pocket. And so I set off sort of once the snow stopped. There was a couple of days it was sort of bright and sunny. And it probably got up, you know, to 3, 4, maybe 5 degrees. It was the warmest it had been the whole time I was up there. And I was watching the snow melting away and I was thinking, right, here's my opportunity to get out of here. And I set off and I'd been watching for the sort of 7 or 8 days I've been there. I saw this knoll and I thought, if I could just get to there, I'll be able to look down the valley and see where this town of Talu is. I'll be able to sort of find it and get to it. And so I set off that day. I sort of packed myself back in my backpack and set off. And it was still really difficult terrain. The snow was still very deep. It's hard to get through. I got up to this knoll. As far as I could look, there was just rocks and trees and cliffs and snow. It was just everywhere. There was no sign of any people. I was just completely stuck. There's just cliffs in front of me, and I thought, oh. And I'd struggled for a number of hours to cover this couple of hundred metres, and I thought, I've got to get back to where I can sort of stay safe and let the snow melt more so I can actually get out of there and climb out of there. And so I got back to my rock, and the next day it started snowing again. So I was sort of just watching his cycles of sort of, you know, a couple of days about snow, and the snow would melt, and it'd bucket down snow again. And I was really and truly stuck there. And so the days went by, and at this stage, sort of, you know, initially I sort of thought if I just stay alive a week, I'll be able to climb out. And then as days went by, I sort of thought, okay, I've just got to stay alive long enough for spring to come and the snow to melt, which now sounds completely ridiculous. But I was thinking if I could just stay alive for a couple of months, I'd be able to sort of get out of there. I wasn't thinking about the fact that in a couple of months I'd be dead with starvation. It was just that drive to try and stay alive. The whole time I was thinking about family and friends and the importance of going out. I could think of so many reasons to live. And it was just so much that I wanted to sort of get back and see and do and such. And that's what kept me going this whole time. I was reading some books to sort of keep me occupied. I had a couple of books. I had Charles Dickens' Great Expectations, which I read about 6 times. Actually thoroughly enjoyed it, and I read it recently again. It's a great book. I had Silence of the Lambs. The first time I read it, I thought, oh, that's not a very uplifting story. The second time, I couldn't get through it, put to one side sort of thing. And I was just sort of doing things in my mind to try and keep myself occupied, keep myself going.
Well, by this time, you must have started to lose track of time, did you?
Came round, so I sort of got lost at a full moon. And it came round, the full moon came round again. So I knew I'd been up there for about a month. I'd been writing letters for a while, but my pen stopped working. Everything was getting broken and such. You know, it's just as it was came around a month, I was starting to get lots of pain in my feet. I'd gotten a cold injury in my feet and feeling like things were looking pretty hopeless. And it was starting to dawn on me, I'm not going to get out of here. I'm not going to survive. I could feel my resolve fading and my hope sort of dimming. And one morning, as I was sitting there, really thinking about, actually, this is hopeless, I heard the sound of his helicopter. And I sort of got up looking to see where his helicopter was. I was in this massive valley. Behind me was a wall. which is probably about 4,000 metres high. Opposite me on the opposite side of the valley was another wall, which was about 5,000 metres high. And I watched as it came out, and I got out where this rock was. There was this big clear space next to it, which I had thought from the start that would be a really good place where I could be spotted from. And so I got out in the middle of this sort of clear space, and I had with me my blue sleeping bag, which obviously contrasts against the snow and things. And I watched this helicopter go up, and it shot up across the valley, up the valley, about my height in altitude, but on the opposite side. And it went up, and it started hovering around this hut where I'd originally gotten lost, where I'd originally sort of had my last night's sleep. And it was sort of circling around, circling around, circling around. And then, every time it kind of turned towards me, I'd be waving my sleeping bag, and it was, kilometres away. I was sort of just hoping that it might be able to spot me as such. And then suddenly it came shooting back down the valley, and I watched this helicopter fly past at speed and sort of saw it go and just fly away. And it was the first time for some days I actually had some hope. I thought, if one helicopter's come up, maybe another helicopter will come up. Maybe another one will come. And sure enough, 3 days later, another helicopter did come up. And this time it came up and it went up to where the hut was, where we'd stayed, hovered around a few times. This time it came back, and it came back on my side of the valley. And I watched it come back, and I could see the pilot, the co-pilot, the cockpit of a helicopter. And I was waving my sleeping bag. As it sailed past, it flew past, I screamed out, "Don't leave me here." But of course, they couldn't hear what I was shouting. They were looking straight to the south towards Kathmandu, and they flew on. I was still sort of feeling hopeful. I thought, okay, well, it's twice. It's come up twice. It'll come up a third time. I went back to my rock, and I went back to my usual routine of sort of collecting my snow and trying to keep myself hydrated and such. The last week I was up there, so I've been up there by this stage, sure, about 33, 34 days. Last week that I was up there, it was really hard. My feet were very painful from a cold injury, plus I was starting to get vitamin deficiencies by this stage, so I was getting what we call neuropathies. The peripheral nerves were getting damaged. Now they're starting to got this constant burning pain in my feet. I had this constant urge that I need to urinate, so I was really feeling very uncomfortable. I just find it very hard to sleep at night. You know, I'd gone from a period initially where I couldn't sleep because I was so cold to getting into a sort of phase of my time up here where I was relatively comfortable because I had enough warm clothes again to sleep again and such, to now not being able to sleep again. And this last week, it was just difficult. And I was thinking a lot about home, thinking a lot about friends, trying to think about, the need to keep going, the need to stay alive. And then I sort of woke up one morning, and I sort of felt how hectic I'd become. I was just, when I went up, I was fairly fit and solid in my build. And I just became emaciated. And so I felt, I'd had no muscle in my thighs or my buttocks. I was just ribs sticking out. And it dawned on me, I'm not going to survive much longer. I'm going to be dead very soon. And I thought, I've got one more chance to walk my way out of here. I've really got to get out now, otherwise I'm not going to be able to walk soon. So I packed up what I thought were the bare essentials in my bag. And then I set off really wobbly by this stage. It's been about sort of almost 40 days since I'd eaten. And I started walking through the snow and falling over such. And up to that point, I'd been very careful to moderate how much snow I took in. And now I was as I was walking, I got this sudden sensation to have to eat as much snow as I could, and I was just consuming it. And then after a short period of time, I started to get incredibly cold, and I was shivering, and I started vomiting, and I kind of fell down the snow. I thought, I'm not strong enough to get out of here. I'm not going to be able to do this. And it was kind of at that point I thought, I just can't do this anymore. I've had enough. I had this straw hat that I'd had with me for quite some time. It fell off my head and fell down in the gully. I just left it there. I didn't worry about it. And I thought about just lying here. I could see the snowstorm coming up through the valley. I thought, just lie here and get covered by snow. I thought, no, it's really important I get back under a rock so my body can be found. So I turned back and walked back up to the rock, climbed way back up to the rock, and just waited there. And I thought to myself, I've just had enough of this. And I had with me means to end my life. I had with me scissors. I had with me shoestrings and things, shoelaces. And I thought I could take my life quickly. But I thought, I don't want my family to know how much I'd suffered. And so I came up with this idea, if I just stop drinking snow, just stop drinking water, I won't last much longer. And so at that point, I stopped taking any more fluids and so. And I was kind of, once I decided that, it was almost sort of contentment came over me. I thought, okay, I don't have to suffer anymore. So for the rest of the day, I didn't drink any snow. And the next day, I didn't drink any snow. And sort of lying there, thinking about things. I'd stopped urinating by this stage. My urine had gone very dark and then stopped. And I was feeling, when I stood up, I was getting very dizzy. And I thought, I'm not going to last much longer now. That's a good thing. And that night, I slept. As I slept, I dreamt. And I dreamt about all my family back home, about my fiancé, and while we were away, I was away for Christmas and New Year's, my birthday. And we were supposed to have our engagement party. I was away for that. And I dreamt about this engagement party back home we were supposed to have. And when I woke up, I just felt terrible. I thought, I'd given up on all these people, let all these people down, all these friends and family. My fiancé, I'd given up and I'd stopped with my will to live. And I made this resolve when I woke up to start drinking snow again and trying to find a way out of this. So the light came up, I crawled out, got some snow. And I was sitting here just sucking on snowballs again, and I heard the sound of a third helicopter. And it came up the valley, went up to the hut where we were, and it came back down. And this time, instead of shooting straight back down to Kathmandu, it started doing circles of the valley. I got up, crawled my way. I couldn't walk anymore. Crawled my way out to the middle of this clear patch where I lay down. And I was just waving my sleeping bag. I had these sort of red thermal underwear on. I pulled my trousers down to show the red thermal underwear. And I watched this helicopter circle around and circle around. And each time it came a little bit close to me, and then finally, it sort of stopped, and they sort of waved as if to let me know they'd spotted me. I crawled back to my rock. I was sort of so cold sitting out there anymore and such, and I thought, it's just amazing. I've been spotted. And I waited, and the helicopter shot off down the valley, and then the light faded later in the day. Of course it would. And in the dark, after some hours after the sun had set, I heard this calling out, namaste, namaste. And I started screaming back, namaste, namaste. And they got closer and closer. And I could hear their footsteps getting louder and louder. And then I was looking expectantly over this rock ledge where I was to sort of see who was coming. And these two Nepalese villagers popped their heads up over the rock ledge. One of them wearing my straw hat, which he'd found. And they said, are you James Scott from Australia? And I said, yes, I am. And they came up and hugged me, and I was in tears, and they're in tears and such. One stayed with me, and the other went back down to get the rest of the search party. And so after the helicopter had gone back to Kathmandu, they said that they'd found me, that they'd spotted me. They thought it was likely me. They couldn't imagine who else would be up there. And they sent a search party in. The main search party had stopped up the sort of hill. But these two fellows said, no, we know you need someone tonight. And they'd sort of climbed on in the dark up these sort of snow-covered cliffs to find me. It was just, really heroic. So Carl Harrison, who was a mountaineer who was leading that search party, he and the rest of the search party got up to me, and Carl explained what had happened and the massive effort that had gone on, which had been led by my sister Joanne. A friend from school, Andrew Ross, and a lot of help from other people local in Nepal to coordinate the search effort. And they'd covered thousands of square kilometres and had advertisements everywhere to try and find me, and they managed to locate me.
Tell me about the moment you actually got lifted out of that place.
The helicopter came in the next day, as explained. I'd get harnessed and then lifted off the mountain next day, and sure enough, the helicopter came in the next day and dropped the rope down. I got attached to harness, and then I got lifted off. And I watched as I got lifted away. I was sort of watching this rock that had been both my sort of shelter and my place of being trapped for so long. I watched that get smaller and smaller. And I got lifted higher, just the most magnificent view of sort of could see over this wall that I've been looking at for so many weeks, and over the actual Himalayas on the other side with the sort of morning sun rising. It just magical country, magical scenery. I got taken to the village of Talu that I thought I'd been getting to for so long, and then got dropped off there, and there were crowds of people. There would have been like 100 people had come in from all the neighbouring villages to see if they'd heard so much about me. And when I got drifted down, got lowered down, people kept coming out and singing out and touching me and such, and I was finding it really quite distressing and overwhelming. And Tom Kreese, who was one of the local gentlemen who was helping my sister Joanne, he was there, and he said, "James, just relax. They want to touch you. They want some of your good luck." And so they got a, you know, I got transferred to another helicopter and then taken back to Kathmandu Airport, where I was reunited with Joanne. And then I was in hospital for a further 12 days in Nepal, and then transferred back to Australia, and then spent some months recovering before resuming my medical studies. And that brings me to today.
James, it's extraordinary the way you can relate it, but I guess every minute up there in the mountains must have, you know, seemed like an eternity. So you had plenty of time to think of the detail and remember the environment you're in. Can I just take you back to the lead up to the moment when you realised you were lost? Because it wasn't the first walk you'd done up there with your other friend from Australia. I think you'd done a little bit of trekking.
Yeah, that's right. So we did part of the Annapurna circuit, went up to Talu, and then came back. So Jomsom trek, I should say. So we did the Jomsom trek and then came back. And that was, again, a lovely introductory walk to the Himalayan countryside.
Hello, this is Giles English, the co-founder of Bremel Watch Company. We're proud to be supporting Dr. Harris with the show, an ambassador and a friend of the brand who symbolises the core of Bremel with its Tested Beyond Endurance motto. As an engineering company, we specialise in the manufacturing of beautifully made mechanical aviation watches that are built to be worn in the boardroom or at Mount Everest. With our strong military links, we work with adventurers all over the world. Now, to learn more, please go to bremel.com and read about the likes of NIMS, who's just smashed the record for climbing the 14 highest peaks in under 7 months, and see the watch he's wearing. Well, thank you for listening and hope you enjoy the show.
I think I'd read in your book that you had, you know, pretty heavy packs at that stage early on, you know, all the gear. But after being in the mountains for a little bit of time and watching the way the locals dealt with the environment, you kind of discarded some of the heavier winter clothing and some of the equipment that maybe in retrospect would have made life a bit more comfortable for you.
The first trek we did, we were well prepared, and we got a lot of advice. We took a couple of guides and things, and you know, it really felt like we'd gone above and beyond what was needed. And the second trek was kind of happened because it was a sort of delay in commencing our placement, and it was sort of fairly spontaneous, so not much planning or thinking. And we were definitely much more complacent the second time. We'd been there, done that, nothing gone wrong, we thought it was okay. And, you know, I think what it, you know, what it highlighted to me sort of in retrospect was that, you know, to, if things go well, you don't need much. But if they don't go well, you need an awful lot. And we weren't prepared for things not going well.
The advice you had from the hostel that you slept in the last night before you got lost was that snow was unlikely as you ascended?
Yeah. So we asked the gentleman who, you know, the lodge keeper about, was it going to snow that day? And he said, no, he thought it'd be okay. I don't know, but I think in retrospect, I think there's some cultural issues there where perhaps he was saying things to make us happy, to, you know, that was the last night that he was staying there too. He was packing up and heading down to, down to Talu himself. So we again, there was a certain sort of, there was certainly a naivety about what we were doing. But I also think people hear the advice they want to hear. And, you know, at the end of the day, we chose, I think the fact we were asking that question meant that we were worried it was going to snow, and yet we still took off up that mountain. And so we ignored what our gut was telling us, that this probably wasn't an okay thing to do.
Yeah, I'm very familiar with that false optimism, because you want to go ahead with a plan and really you're going to do it whatever anyone says, and you hope you hear the answers that you want, but you're probably going to push on regardless. So what kind of sleeping bag did you have? Because it sounds like that was your most vital piece of survival equipment.
Yeah, we had a sleeping bag. I can't recall what the brand was, but it would have been, you know, rated for about 0 degrees. It wasn't extra warm. I had a good ski jacket, but not a heavy ski jacket. It's the sort of gear that you might take if you were going hiking down in Tasmania, for example.
Yeah.
You know, it certainly wasn't the sort of gear that one needed for minus 20 degree conditions, which I found myself in.
And did the temperature drop to minus 20? Do you think? Obviously, you didn't have a thermometer, but would that be your feeling?
My feeling would be certainly would be less than minus 5. Mm. I think beyond that, it's hard to know. You know, it's all guesses. All I know is I was pretty bloody cold.
This was your first visit to mountainous terrain. Had you done any hiking or, you know, extensive bushwalking in the past?
Yeah, back in Queensland we had. So, you know, we're pretty used to doing overnight and 3 or 4 day hikes and such back in Queensland, and did a lot of camping back in Queensland. It was the first experience of sort of going to really cold country and hiking in country that get very cold.
And genuinely the first time you'd seen snow?
I'd been to the Victorian Alps in June or July that year in 91, and we'd gone at a time when it was very little snow, not enough to open the runs, and I was sitting there on that rock thinking, isn't this ironic?
Have you been back to the snow? Are you keen to see it again?
Yeah, I've been back to the snow. So we went back to Nepal a year later just to thank everyone and, you know, tidy everything up. But since then I've been skiing a number of times in various countries. I haven't got a passion to go to the snow, nor am I phobically avoidant of it, but I do enjoy going skiing when I can.
So tell me about the conversation that you had with your walking buddy at the moment when you're separated, because I'm struggling to understand why anyone would continue up the mountain like your friend did. What was up there that he saw as a safe refuge?
Yeah, that was really tricky. So he was he had a plane he had to catch to Thailand within a certain time frame, and if he didn't continue on, he was going to miss that plane. And, you know, I suppose now, I mean, it's easy for me as a medical specialist, if you miss a plane, it's a nuisance, you just buy another ticket, and, you know, that's expensive and a hassle, it's affordable. I think as a student or as a missing a plane becomes a big deal because it's super expensive, it's unaffordable. And I think for this bloke, you know, the idea of missing his flight was going to really put him out. I didn't have a plane. I didn't have the same sort of travel restrictions that he had. And so, or the same sort of limitations when I had to get out of Kathmandu, Dubai. So he had to push on from his perspective. And we both thought at the time he was taking the bigger risk.
Mm.
You know, I was doing the safer thing. And, you know, I spent a lot of time when I was stuck up Mount Thing. Geez, you know, I wonder if he survived. I was sure he would have died up there. What had actually happened was that as he went up, I spoke to him some time after I came back to Australia, and he kept going up and up, and he actually got above the storm. And there was a group that had come from the other side, who were crossing a pass from the other side with Nepalese guides, And they looked at the weather and they said, no, we must turn back. And they were able to sort of guide him back down the other side of the mountain. So it ended, it went very well for him and he got back safely. And when he got back to Kathmandu, you know, he let another one of my friends who was there know where we'd parted. He said, oh, James will be fine. I took the risk. Don't worry, he'll be fine. And then this fellow hiker flew on to Thailand. And then when I didn't come back, my friend Tim, who was in Kathmandu waiting for me, took him some days and he started to panic. He said, oh, no, something's gone terribly wrong. And then he raised the alarm at that point. So it was quite a delay between when I got lost and when the alarm got raised that, I hadn't returned and there were problems.
Yeah, you'd have to say he was bloody lucky and you were a bit unlucky. The fact that you found the footbridge or the timber across the creek, which was only 200 metres from the lodge where you were supposed to stay, just in those whiteout conditions, you couldn't find it.
Yeah, it's just extraordinary. Without that creek, there's no way I would have gotten back down. So the creek was a sort of landmark that I could find my way back down. It was on the map. It was there. As I descended, it got bigger and bigger and bigger, as creeks do when they go downhill. But, there was sort of a thing that allowed me to orientate myself on the map. And, the really frustrating thing, Harry, was that the whole time I wasn't lost in terms of I knew where I was on the map. I just couldn't get to where I had to get to. So I was lost to everyone outside, but for me, I knew where I was. I just couldn't get to where I needed to get to.
Obviously, there was a big search, and your sister Joanne played an enormous role in driving that and making sure that it persisted when all hope really was lost. And I think even if you were on the other side of the coin, you would have probably given up hope for anyone who was out there for more than a week or so, I presume. But she was very determined woman to push on and convince people to keep looking and fundraised, I presume, to make that happen. The area that you were in, and you say that you feel like you knew where you were on the map, was that outside the boundaries of where people would expect to search, though?
It was, because when my hiking companion, Mark, went and told Tim where we last were, it was sort of a fairly short conversation. They chatting away. They said, oh, James is fine. We separated. And then anyway, amidst that, Tim misinterpreted where that was. So the search was actually taking place in a completely different area, different valley sort of thing. That was where the focus was. And there was questions raised about, what if I were in this valley that I was in? What if I was there? Is it possible? And people said, well, he couldn't be able to get there from where he last was. He wouldn't be able to climb there. And if he's in there, he'll be dead anyway because the terrain's so difficult and such. So it wasn't sort of the focus of a search. And it was sort of only when Mark got back to Australia about a month later that he corrected and said, no, we didn't separate. We are searching. We're separating. We separated in this other area, and that's why the first helicopter appeared after a month. The whole time they'd been searching the wrong location. And, I think that must have been very distressing for everyone back home to sort of realise, all these resources have gone into searching the wrong area. And I think at that stage they were just looking for a body, so that they'd actually didn't have any hope of finding anyone alive. But my sister, being my sister, sort of said, well, we're only going to get one chance at this. We've got to do everything we can to try and get an answer as to sort of what had happened to me. Persisting with the search defied all logic. I think so many people said to her, why are you wasting your time? Why are you wasting your money? you should just go home. He's obviously dead. But Joanne persisted in spite of it.
And she consulted a guru of some kind who gave the advice that you were still alive and a suggested search location. I was curious to know whether that location was correct.
Yeah, the location was correct. So she didn't initiate this herself. I don't think she would have. She got recommended by someone, there's a Tibetan Lama, who she consulted a local man of faith to find out a local monk to find out on recommendation of someone there who said, you know, this gentleman's got special skills, special abilities. He might be able to provide some insight as where James is. And this person looked at the map and he said, you know, James is alive and you'll find him here, and pointed to the valley that I was in. Now, Joanne on one hand was thrilled to hear this news, and that was lovely to hear. But on the other hand, I don't think she believed it for a moment that his advice was true, and why he selected that and what he knew, who knows? Maybe he was lucky. Maybe he had insights. Who knows? The family were getting inundated with advice from psychics and well-meaning people saying, you know, James is alive, you'll find him here, you'll find him there. Some of it was really unhelpful. I've had a dream, James is alive, but he's bleeding and you've got to find him within 24 hours. So, you know, so I think the family became very skeptical of sort of people that weren't sort of directly involved in the search, because there was a lot of advice being offered.
No one said James is alive, but he's run out of chocolate.
No one said that. No, that's right.
Yeah, I mean, it's fascinating to ponder. Obviously, as a man of science myself, I find hard to, you know, see that there's any basis to it. But that's a pretty good coincidence. So we'll take that one on notice, I guess. But you had quite a strong faith, I think, in the book. And is that something that really helped you get through the difficult times?
Yeah, look, it certainly did. I had a strong faith. I have a strong faith. It's really interesting. I never felt alone up there. You know, I felt that God was with me. I felt my family was with me. I really felt cared about, looked after in a whole range of ways. And I kept in my mind, I mean, so I think that really sort of helped support me, that sort of sense of not being on my own. You know, that's something which supports me to this day. I think there's some other things which are really helpful. So I keep coming back to the connection I have with families and friends, and I think that confers so much resilience in people. If you've got people who you love and you know 100% they love you, that gives people real strength, gives people real inner strength. I kept going back to comparing my situation to that of others. And the people that came to my mind were, you know, I'd done a stint on a burns ward and I'd seen the horrific injuries that some people on the ward had had. And whilst my situation was bad, I had my mind, no one has physically harmed me. I'm not physically injured. I've got a lot to be thankful for. I can still get out of this. That kept going through my mind. I thought about the Australian prisoners of war back from World War II. This really sort of, I was very immersed in thinking and thought about what they had to endure. And I thought, you know, if they can endure that, I can endure this. So I kept putting my situation relative to others, and that gave me a sense of, yeah, look, this is hard, this is bad, but others have had much worse. Just keep going.
I mean, you were a pretty robust guy, it's fair to say, when you went into this. You were a black belt in karate, obviously very fit, and the karate suggests that you are quite disciplined and focused in what you do when you turn your mind to something. Do you think that kind of personality type in itself helped you survive or prepared you?
Yeah, I think that I think karate is a way of life. It's a way of living. It's an attitude to how you see the world and how you see yourself. And so when you train in traditional karate, you develop a discipline. You learn that, you know, you face a series of physical and mental challenges in your training, and you're pushed, if you're in a good club with a good instructor, you're pushed to really challenge yourself every training session. And you get stronger mentally and physically. And I think at the time when I was up there in Nepal, you know, I was fit, I was strong, I was quite skilled at karate. And I think I developed this sort of mental attitude that, you know, just face challenges and keep working through them and not give up and such. And that was enormously helpful. And then there was, you know, I had well-developed muscles, particularly on my legs, my buttocks and chest and things, latissimus. These are big muscles. It's a lot to feed off when you're starving. So I think that also sustained me for quite a period of time as well.
You're listening to Real Risk, the adventure podcast with Richard Harris.
What did you find, apart from the mental anguish and the fear, I guess, that would come in a situation like that, what was the worst physical symptom for you? Was it the thirst or the hunger or the cold? Which of those three, for example, sort of troubled you the most?
Yeah, at different times they all did. The thirst wasn't too bad because I had no shortage of snow to drink. Just had to be patient with that. Initially the cold, because I'd lost all my gear and I was wet, and that was, you know, cold, just get that, you know, that bone chilling cold. It's like that. It goes right into your bones. So it's cold. So that was very uncomfortable. And then there was a hunger, and the hunger was worse for the first 2 weeks. So, you know, each day I seemed to get hungrier, and I went through different phases where initially I was sort of thinking about food, you know, I'd sort of dream about food and wake up salivating. I was thinking about food, but I think about food that was sort of high in fats and carbohydrates, like a KFC and stuff like this, which, you know, back then we used to eat a lot of. You don't need to see much more options nowadays if you take away, but KFC was, Hungry Jack's was about it back in our day. So, you know, you used to think about those sort of, you know, high calorie foods initially, but as over the couple of weeks, you know, change and towards the end, I was really craving fruit and vegetables. And obviously that was sort of trying to get in those vitamins that I would have been becoming deficient in as time went on. So it wasn't so much hunger at that stage, but a real drive to sort of take in the food that I needed at that point in time.
Isn't it interesting that your body knows what you need and starts to make you seek out those specific things? It's very clever.
It's fascinating. It's fascinating, yeah. So, I mean, but I think, so in answer to your question, what's the best, that last week was hard. You know, when my feet really started burning, and that urgency to urinate all the time just never let up, and I just couldn't get comfortable. That was really hard. So every phase was hard, but the problems changed.
You talked about, you know, peripheral neuropathy and the vitamin deficiencies, and I know that that had some long-term effects, and unfortunately you weren't able to pursue your career in surgery that you were considering, but because of those neurological problems and visual disturbance that stuck with you. Have you had long-term ongoing issues with those things?
Yeah, so I've still got a slight double vision, what we call in medicine diplopia. You know, it's enough to cause me slight impairment in terms of some of the sporting activities that I imagine I'd still be doing, like tennis and stuff like that. It's very hard to do now because of the visual disturbance, but it's not enough to sort of get in the way of my day-to-day functioning. You know, I can still drive, I can still jog, I can still go to work. There's been some mild impairments.
And I was curious that you went from the idea of being a surgeon to now being a psychiatrist. They are, in medical parlance, pretty much opposites, most people would consider. So what drew you to psychiatry?
I enjoyed everything. So I can't think of a specialty or term I didn't love. I find the whole area of medicine just absolutely fascinating, and how the body works and how it heals itself. So it's just remarkable. And then I did my resident years. It's kind of when you're a junior doctor and you're getting further training. And I enjoyed the terms. There were some terms which obviously you need good fine motor skills and be able to see what you're doing and such. And so it really ruled out all the procedural specialties. And when I thought back of my second year of residency training, I thought, look, I really enjoyed my psychiatry terms. I really enjoyed my pediatric terms. And then I went and spoke to my senior colleagues in both disciplines, and the psychiatrists were a cheerful, happy group, sort of talking about how interesting their jobs were. The pediatricians were all tired and cranky and And I'm sick of getting woken up every night for babies that are being born. So I end up doing child psychiatry because I thought, you know, I get a bit of a best of both worlds that way. But I found, you know, it's a career choice, which you sort of do these things. And it's not like I think, oh, I'm going to be a psychiatrist. I thought I did it. And I haven't had a day where I've regretted it because I think people are so interesting. You know, I talk to people who had remarkable stories. They've had their own challenges, and obviously they, you know, not as, I suppose, unusual and dramatic as what mine were, but they're certainly huge challenges growing up in very difficult home situations where every day is a survival for life, and they manage to get through, and many of them manage to be very successful. And it, for every day, I kind of look at sort of the resilience of humans. You know, it's a real testament to the human character, the people who I talk to, that they are just so inspiring.
You would have unique insights into PTSD and also the concept of post-traumatic growth. Did you struggle at all when you came home? Was it difficult for you?
Yeah, look, I struggled for a couple of reasons. You know, I think the overwhelming traumatic situation and particularly the guilt of what I put everyone through, that was really hard. You know, that there's no easy way of saying what I did was completely stupid. And, you know, looking at every which way, it was just a dumb thing to do. And as a result of that, you know, I put my family through enormous distress and my fiance through enormous distress. And that took me a long time to come to terms with, you know, what a dumb thing to do. And you know, I mean, the reality is we all do dumb things. It's just sometimes the consequences are bigger than others. It's like the person that goes 65K an hour and get away with it, you know, 99 times out of 100. So at one time when you need to stop, you don't. It's terrible. It's a dumb thing to do to go 65K an hour when you don't think about it. So, you know, that I've sort of come to terms with that. I still think what I did was stupid. The other thing, though, was when I came back and all of the attention, and I think sort of when you're traumatized, really you just need to be with people who you know and can trust. But because I came back to this intense scrutiny and enormous amount of media attention, that was really difficult. That was exactly what I didn't need at that stage. And that was very hard, and some of the skepticism that arose and people sort of saying, oh, it can't be true and such. You know, if you go through a hard time, what you don't want then is someone to say at the end of it, oh, actually, I don't believe it, that happened. I think you're making it up. Very invalidating. So that was difficult as well. But, I mean, like all things, time heals. You just sort of work your way through and you get back to, okay, well, what's the purpose of this? And it's about sort of doing good and being with people and enjoying life. And you can sort of move on with those things go. So, and I think whilst, you know, the experience cost me a lot in terms of my physical health and some things, it did provide me with enormous opportunities for post-traumatic growth.
Yeah, that's a concept that I'm obviously really interested in now that I'm meeting more and more people who have been through trauma. And the concept was first related to me by Jill Hicks, who's an amazing Australian woman who was in London and was on the subway during one of the bombings over there and, you know, lost both her lower limbs and had devastating injuries and came as close as you can to dying, obviously, and had every reason in the world to be so angry and spiteful about what had happened. And she's turned that all around into this amazing quest for peace on earth, basically. It's just she's an amazing woman, and she talks about this idea of post-traumatic growth. And I'm fascinated why some people suffer and some people recover and then actually grow and great things come from what's happened. And I guess that's a topic for another podcast entirely. But, you know, the human psyche is – and now I'm really getting outside my field of expertise, but, you know, I've been making some observations, I guess, and I'm, you know, I look at, for example, the Vietnam vets who came back to some scrutiny like you did, and they'd been through a terrible experience, and then they found that they were very much out of favour with the public, to rub salt into the wound and to not come back to a hero's welcome like the Australians from the First and Second World War did, must be devastating in terms of your mental health. And maybe that's, is that why we see some people suffering more than we would have expected perhaps out of those conflicts?
Yeah, look, I think sort of when anyone's been through a traumatic experience, validation is just so important, you know, sort of people being aware and acknowledging that it has been a really difficult time. And I think there's obviously been differences between wars and how the public's received people, received returned soldiers. There's also differences with people's experiences. You know, you think about getting onto a really controversial topic, for example, institutional sexual abuse, and the fact that these people who had been through so much trauma had their claims denied. They were told they were liars. They were told they were the cause of abuse, responsible for it. And that's the worst thing you can do to someone. So there's a whole lot of ways in which, you know, we can help people be able to sort of grow after a traumatic event, recover and become more resilient, or alternatively cause so much more distress and morbidity.
It's funny. It's not funny at all, actually. It was terrible that there was so much controversy about your story. And in fact, I was working in the UK at the time, and I remember quite clearly hearing about this Australian medical student who had survived for 43 days with no food, just this these magical two chocolate bars at the start, which were consumed in the first day. And he'd come out, you know, emaciated, and, you know, the media had found it all fascinating. And I remember my first thought thinking, well, that's impossible. No one can survive in the snow for that long. And maybe he's just been tucked up in a hotel and starving himself to get, you know, to get famous. And what a cruel thing to think of someone, and what a terrible thing for to be on the receiving end, as I believe you were to some degree. So that return to Australia must have been really a mixed blessing.
Yeah, it was a mixed blessing. I can remember probably, you know, a couple of weeks after being back in Australia, saying to my mother at the time, I wish I'd never been found. I mean, that's how awful it was. Mm. And that's terrible that someone can get to that. So, you know, you think about a young person, I'm 50 now, 51 now, think about doing that to a 22-year-old. That's a terribly unkind thing to do. I think also it reflects the story was just so hard to believe. Like, you know, who would think? I mean, fortunately, it doesn't happen very often, but it can happen. And I guess I can't explain why I survived as long as I did. I did. It's just what happened. I get the skepticism that comes with it. And I suppose I don't think I've ever had anyone there I've sat down and talked to and explained what happened leave and say, oh, I still don't believe you. You know, I think people sort of, when they sort of hear the story and, oh, okay, I get it, sort of thing. So I don't know. It's just, it's difficult to believe, isn't it?
Well, it's difficult to believe, and that's why it's so amazing, James. And, you know, like all great survival stories, it speaks a lot about your strength and resilience, but also the potential for humans, you know, what we can actually endure if we don't give up and if we don't roll over and say, you know, oh, I'm finished. And it's extraordinary that you got to the end of that. You came very close to doing that in the last couple of days, but I think by that stage, boy, everyone would be asking themselves the same questions. So I found the whole story incredibly inspiring. I read your book, which is still available, and just remind me what the title of that is so we can give it a plug.
Lost in the Himalayas. So it's just available now on the internet. We've got to, at some stage, we'll sit down and get out a digital version so we can get it available again.
It is a great read and definitely worth finding a copy somewhere. And I still maintain it would make an amazing movie subject, but I know you're a bit shy of that idea because it's probably one of those things that, you know, is a part of your life that you don't need to go back to. But it's so compelling and such an extraordinary story, James. So I'm very grateful for your time today, and thank you for sharing the story with us.
It was a pleasure, Harry. No worries. Well, good to see you again. We'll need to get together again in person.
We do. Thank you, James.
All right, mate.
That's it for this episode of Real Risk. If you're a risk taker or know someone who'd be good for the show, please send me an email on admin@speleopix.com.au. I'd love to hear from you. Let me know what you think of the podcast. Subscribe, give me a rating, but most importantly, join me for the next one. We'll see you again on Real Risk.